Chapter 39. Inside the clock. Back in the straitjacket again. One of the matrons, it seemed, had reported Beth throwing up her morning pills.
"Just until you're calm," the doctor said as she was buckled in. "If I take those blasted tablets, I'm halfway to a coma," Beth snarled, thrashing. "How calm do you want me, you pill-peddling hack?"
"An extra dose, doctor."
The matron spoke up, cream smooth, the same matron whose arm Beth had burned with a cigarette.
"Liddell has been misbehaving lately. An orderly said she made indecent overtures to him in a linen closet. These nymphomaniac types."
Her eyes danced, spiteful. Beth reared back and spat on the front of her apron. A needle pricked.
"Just wait, you nasty little thing," the matron said as soon as the doctor left. "When they get you under the scalpel..."
"When?"
Beth hissed. But the matron was gone, the world sliding away into smoke and mirrors. Beth's veins felt unclean, as if her blood had been greased. She found herself weeping at some point and forced the tears away. Tears would wear her mind down like water on stone, and her mind was all she had.
"I break codes. I eat secrets. Enigma was no match for me. Neither is this place."
Breathe in, breathe out, ignore the numbness of her trapped hands. Think of something else, not scalpels and spiteful matrons and oblivious doctors with their unfair punishments. Unfairly punished. Beth's drugged memory turned up something long forgotten. Osler, hauled up by Commander Travis at BP, raked over the coals about Prince Philip's Nazi relatives, interrogated about what Osler had guessed were some missing decrypted messages from Hut 3. When had that been? June 42. If someone had snatched files, they could easily have reported beautiful, highly visible Osler, who had sauntered over from Hut 4 on routine business and diverted attention from the presence of a traitor.
"Who?" Beth thought.
Back to that again, endlessly turning over old memories, hoping for some fresh insight. But none of her ISK colleagues had ever worked in Hut 3.
"So don't focus on the where," Beth thought. "Focus on the when. June of 42.
Peggy Rock had returned to Bletchley Park from her breakdown that same month. Peggy, the cleverest woman Beth knew. Had there really been a breakdown? Or had she been somewhere else, meeting someone, passing information? Beth had weighed Peggy's name before on her list of suspects, and always cringed from the thought. Peggy, a traitor, fair-haired, brilliant Peggy who had shown her how to rod. But Peggy worked in ISK. She had disappeared and been gone for months. She had returned to work, Dilly's best codebreaker aside from Beth. A woman as clever as Peggy could have found a way to walk into Hut 3 and out again with a file, surely. And with Dilly no longer keeping an eye on his section's day-to-day routine. Peggy. Yes, she might be the one. Or any of Dilly's team. Dear friends all, because Beth had made friends almost exclusively inside Knox's section, except for Osler and Mab, who now hated her. What a cruel twist of fate that her friends were all suspects, and her enemies were the only ones she was sure of.
"Come on, you two,"
Beth thought throughout the endless afternoon, canvas-bound and helpless.
"Come through."
York.
Mab dropped her teaspoon.
"You want us to go where?" "To Clockwell, to see Beth."
Osler saw they were getting glances from the other patrons of Betty's tea shop. And no wonder. Two well-groomed women in new-look billows of skirt, dagger-eyed, going at each other over the teacups for the past half hour.
"Try not to look so hacked off, will you? We're attracting attention."
Mab bared all her teeth in a smile, violently stirring her tea.
"I am not going to a madhouse. You're willing to leave her there because you're afraid."
Reverting to whispering, making sure no one was walking past.
"When she may be perfectly sane, and there may be a traitor who betrayed Bletchley Park, who betrayed all of us who worked there, walking free. Now that really takes the biscuit, darling."
Osler gave Mab a withering look.
"I knew you were a ruthless cow, but I didn't think you'd become a coward. I'm not afraid, you featherweight gossip page hack."
Mab reverted to whispers too.
"I'm pointing out that we could be breaking the law by contacting her at all.
We would also be breaking the law if we allowed the secrecy of our work to be compromised."
Osler leaned forward.
I may be a featherweight gossip page hack now, but I take my oath seriously. But you can't possibly entertain the notion that someone at BP... Yes, I can. Remember the time I was hauled into Travis's office and accused of lifting files from Hut 3? I ranted to you and Beth about it. The rifled Hut 4 box files too. Mab fiddled with her strand of black pearls. So we report this to someone higher up, someone unconnected with Beth's section. No one is going to take it seriously because they think Beth's gone potty. But we lived with her for years, and we know her better than anyone. If we see her in the flesh, put the question to her ourselves. However we can make that happen, Osler thought. We'll know if she's crazy. We'll know if she's lying. Mab spoke very low. And what if we don't think she's lying? A long silence. We'll think of something. Osler pushed her teacup away. Perhaps there's something my godfather could do. Pull strings, or you could ring Philip, Mab suggested. It must be nice having the future royal consort in your address book. He's got to be worth a ring on the telephone, even if he came up short as far as rings on the finger. Mention Philip again, Osler snapped, and I'll cram those pearls up your nose until you are sneezing naked, Queen Mab. You aren't exactly endearing yourself to me, considering you want my help. I don't want your help, you blithering bitch. I need it. I need another pair of eyes on Beth to figure out if she's talking straw or gold. Osler began tugging on her gloves. The 11:05 leaves tomorrow morning, and it stops 2 miles from Clockwell. I plan to be on it. Don't count on me joining you. Mab finally broke down and took a scone, reaching for the butter dish. No one could ever count on you for anything, Mab. Break form for once, why don't you? Osler rose, smiling sweetly. Not too much butter, darling. Watch that waist. Right now, it's all you've got going for you. 5 years ago. June, 1942. Chapter 40. From Bletchley Blethering's, June, 1942. Boffins and gents, stop trying to peek into the hut with all the machine racket going on inside. It's just a rumour that the Wrens sometimes strip down and work in their knickers. Job's up! It was always a moment, Mab reflected, when a proper stop was logged on one of the bomb machines, when all the checks came back and it wasn't a mistake that had stopped the drums whirring, but success. Who knew what might come from the bomb's latest break? Maybe intelligence important enough to go straight to Churchill's desk. Ever since his visit, Mab had felt a bit proprietary about the Prime Minister. He wasn't just Britain's PM, he was her PM. Strip down! Wren Stevens sighed as she and Mab began unplugging the great wired back of the machine. I wish we could strip down. They'd finally moved from windowless, claustrophobic Hut 11 to new-built 11A, which had an actual air-conditioning unit. But the unit was on the fritz, as the Yanks would say, and the summer heat inside the hut was overwhelming. Mab felt sweat running down her back, and the Wrens in their smart, brass-buttoned uniforms had it even worse. Well, why don't we? She replied with a grin. Who's going to see us? The Wrens laughed uncertainly, but Mab was fizzing along, carefree and happy. She was going to see Francis tomorrow. They'd have 3 days together in Keswick. Let's have a bit of mischief. She yanked her sweaty frock over her head and her gummy slip after it, hanging them on a nail. She stretched her arms, standing in her knickers and brassiere. Much better. Right, I'm with you. Stevens began unbuttoning her uniform, and soon they were all stripping down and going back to man their machines and their unmentionables. Mab carefully tweezed the tiny drumwires apart, plugged up the back for a new menu, and gave Aggie a pat. Ready to go, you cranky cow! She set it in motion, for once not minding the clacking drone. There were many more bomb machines now besides these. So much traffic poured through BP, the handful of bombs here couldn't possibly cope. And it would be dangerous anyway to keep all the machines in one place where a single Luftwaffe strike could knock out Britain's entire decoding capacity. The Wrens said that there were stations in Adstock Manor, Wavenden and Gayhurst now. Mab wondered if any of the Wrens at those stations were on duty in their knickers. The shift was about to turn over and the operators shrugging back into their clothes when a young Wren slid through the door with a miserable look. Why the long face? Mab asked.
Does anyone know Wren Bishop? The girl blurted. Stationed at RAF Chicksands.
I knew her from training in Dumbartonshire, one of the other Wrens volunteered.
She's being sent home. It's terrible.
The Wren lowered her voice.
There was a baby. She was seeing an American officer. Supposedly she was 6 months along, trying to keep it hidden. Until last night. Last night she had it. Or something happened, and it was dead, and she tried to hide it in a drawer. And the officers I overheard talking about it, they didn't even care. They were just saying things about loose morals.
She burst into tears. Two of the others hugged her. Mab wrapped her arms around herself, suddenly chilled despite the choking heat. Bloody men, one of the Wrens spat. She's done in the WRNS now, and what's going to happen to the fellow who got her in trouble? He'll be giving some other girl the same line in a week. Mab quoted the rhyme. Same old yank, same old tune. She hadn't known Wren Bishop, but the news cast a pall over her mood. She couldn't muster a smile on the train ride north the following morning, not until she descended in a fine mist of Lake District rain and saw Francis. He was leaning against the station wall, hat brim slanting over his brow, and when he looked up and saw her, he went utterly still. Mab stood, letting him look, letting the other passengers stream around her. She'd scoured London for the hat, pale straw, with a cornflower blue ribbon around the crown and silk netting. As close as she could find to the hat he'd described the long-ago girl choosing in a Paris shop in 1918. In the letter, Mab had read about 300 times. She'd spent a shocking amount of money on it, and she didn't care. Mab lifted her chin, straightened the hat as if before an imaginary mirror, raised her eyebrows. By the time he was done kissing her, the hat had fallen off and blown clear across the station.
That's no way to treat a poetical inspiration,
Mab scolded, retrieving it.
How did you find the exact one?
He placed it tenderly back over her hair.
By enduring the rolled eyes of every clerk in London when they heard me ask for wafty sort of netting.
You couldn't have been more specific in your details when you decided to fix this memory in your mind forever.
Mab slid her arm through his.
Remembering spotted netting or close weave netting would have been a lot more helpful.
I stand by wafty. I know nothing about female attire. Let's get to the hotel so I can peel you out of yours.
I don't deserve this, Mab thought as they tumbled into bed. I don't deserve him. She'd always thought of being a good wife in terms of keeping a tidy house, setting a good table, warming a welcoming bed. How did you return this quiet, devastating riptide of devotion? How did you earn it?
Mab,
Francis said in astonishment when she dragged herself out of bed in the pink light of dawn as he was pulling on his walking boots.
You don't have to come along on my morning walks. You hate rising early. You hate getting your hair wet.
It's time I learned to be a country lass, Mab said determinedly. Long walks in the woods, sensible shoes. I'll love it.
She was cursing inside before they made it out of Keswick.
There's a lovely view up the hill quite close, Francis said.
Apparently quite close meant 5 miles. He strode along easily, hands in his pockets, shaking off whatever cobwebs of war came in the night. So Mab did her best to struggle in silence, her hair flattening in the fine drizzle. She was too out of breath to enjoy the view when they reached the top. It was pouring anyway, too hard to see anything but grey waves of rain gusting across dough and water. Francis whistled through his teeth as he looked off the rocky point over the water.
The bloody man wasn't even out of breath.
Well, it's usually a lovely view, he remarked.
Spiffing, Mab bit off, massaging her toes.
All right, country lass.
Francis grinned.
How much did you hate this?
I look at a view like this,
Mab said, waving a hand at the water, the trees, the sweep of clouds. And I want to see something paved.
That's my city girl.
He slid an arm around her waist.
Maybe tomorrow morning we both stay in bed. Stow the hike.
At least it's not hot.
Mab gave a half smile.
You wouldn't believe the sweatshop my hat has turned into.
She told him the story of the Wrens stripping down and working in their underwear. Glad she could tell him about her work, even if just a little. She'd hate to be Osler, always keeping mum with her royal suitor. Francis laughed as Mab finished, and she felt rich. He still didn't laugh very often.
You realise every chap at Bletchley Park will turn into a peeping Tom once the word gets around? And when the Yanks arrive...
Mab's smile faded as she remembered the Yank who had supposedly got Ren Bishop into trouble.
What's that you just thought of?
Francis caught the flicker of her expression. A Ren I heard about at BP. Leaning back against the nearest rock, her shoulder against Francis's, Mab surprised herself by telling him. She hadn't ever imagined talking to a husband about such things.
Poor girl.
He shook his head.
That's... ugly.
An old story, Mab said. Women get in trouble, and if the men won't marry them, there's only a handful of choices. Hoping for a miscarriage, or doing something to help that along. Something that might well kill you in the process. Or going off somewhere to have the baby and give it up.
Or going somewhere with your mother, somewhere no one knows you, and giving her name at the hospital instead of your own,
Francis said calmly.
Then going home and telling your friends and family she had the baby, and you have a new little sister.
Mab froze. For a moment she thought her heart had stopped altogether.
Oh.
He turned, hands in his pockets, looking wry.
I wasn't trying to give you a shock. I thought you'd guessed by now that I knew.
Mab still didn't know if her heart was beating or not. How? She managed to say before her throat locked.
The first time I saw you with Lucy. The way you looked at her. Just a flash when you touched her hair.
I gave myself away, Mab thought. So much obsessive discretion over the years, and all it took was the wrong glance when someone who cared was watching.
It didn't shock me, Mab. I've heard of such things before.
It hadn't been till weeks after that horrible night Mab had been left by the side of the road that she'd realized Lucy was coming. By then she'd have rather been torn apart by red-hot fishhooks than ever, ever contact Jeffrey Irving again.
That's why the first thing you asked of me was how I felt about taking Lucy into our home,
Francis said.
I could see why it meant so much.
My mother isn't a very good mother. Mab felt the words wrench and twist, as if they were being forged between her teeth. She's free with the slaps. She doesn't care if her children run about with holes in their knickers. She'll take Lucy out of school and send her to work as soon as she can. That's what she did with all her children. She's not a bad woman, just worn out and impatient. But I can't really harangue her, because she agreed to raise my... Mab stopped for nearly an entire minute. She had never said the two words out loud before, had hardly ever said them in her head. From the day she'd given birth in an anonymous charity hospital and seen the baby carried out in a blanket, she'd told herself over and over, "That's my sister. That's my sister, Lucy." She agreed to raise my daughter for me, Mab whispered, and felt the tears begin to slide. Mum didn't have to do that. She could have tossed me out on my ear. She could have given me a few quid and told me to get rid of it. She could have told the whole neighbourhood I was a slut. She called me that plenty of times, and she slapped me black and blue. But she said she wasn't going to see her youngest dying in some back alley with a coat hanger and a bottle of gin. And then she said she guessed I wasn't going to be her youngest after all. And by the end of the week, there was a story about how she and my dad had had a weekend when he was last in town, before she kicked him out for good. And there were plans to go visit him up north with me and see if things worked out. No one really looked surprised when she was back 6 months later with a baby. Some people knew, of course, but it had all been properly explained. Mab scrubbed at her cheeks. So I don't really have the right to say my mum's not doing such a good job raising Lucy. She didn't have to raise her at all.
But you want more for Lucy?
Francis was listening with every drop of concentration in him, leaning against the rock, his shoulder pressing Mab's. Everything I made myself into, I had to fight to do. The books, the clothes, the secretarial course, all of it. With Mum and everyone else saying I was an uppity bitch. I don't want that for Luce. I want her to go to school, a proper school where she gets to play hockey in a clean gym slip and learn maths. I want her to have the kind of vowels I had to teach myself by eavesdropping on university students. I want her to have little shiny riding boots and a pony. Francis put his arms around her. Mab sagged against him, raw to the core. Please, she heard herself beg. Tough-shelled Mabel from Shoreditch, who never begged anyone for anything, suddenly needing reassurance more than she needed air.
Please tell me what you're thinking. Please tell me I won't lose you over this.
I'm thinking...
He pulled back, tugged a strand of wet hair off her cheek.
That my blasted office is sending me to Scotland for a few months, but that when I get back, you should bring Lucy to Coventry so we can show her her future home, including where the pony will live.
Then he held Mab quietly as she clung to him. Blinking over his shoulder, she saw the rain clouds that rolled back from Derwentwater. The lake had turned a sudden, spectacular blue, and the fields around it exploded like green and gold velvet under a sudden drenching of sunshine.
You're right, she choked. It's a lovely view.
Chapter 41. From Bletchley Blethering's, June, 1942. This fine summer weather means romance, judging from the number of BP engagements rumoured. What the huts and night shifts hath joined together, let no one put asunder. 2 weeks after the conversation with Sheila Zarb, Beth became a thief.
Beth Finch!
Giles's voice hovered somewhere between amused and offended.
Are you actually rummaging in my wallet?
No, yes.
Beth could feel the things she'd taken, nearly burning a hole in her pocket. She'd just managed to ease Giles's wallet back into his jacket where it hung over his chair, a much easier job in the large, crowded, new-built canteen than it would have been in the old mansion dining room. But he'd ambled back with his tray faster than anticipated.
I needed something. I didn't steal. I left you 2 shillings in place.
I don't really fancy anyone taking a poke in my wallet who isn't me.
He dumped his tray on the table.
What did you need so badly?
Beth
couldn't say another word. It was 4 in the morning and the canteen was full of tired people jostling for plates of corned beef and prunes. Beth ducked her head, avoiding his eyes.
I can't say.
Giles went through his wallet. His brows rose.
Well, I'm +2 shillings and -2.
Please don't say it.
Beth squeezed her eyes shut in agony.
Please, Giles.
He sat back in his chair with a grin.
Wouldn't dream of it.
She fled before he could make any more jokes.
Beth.
Harry stopped in surprise, coming out of Hut 8 5 hours later. Beth had been wondering what to do if he worked a double, but here he was, rumpled and tired-looking, shrugging into his jacket.
You're off shift.
Of course he was. It was 9 sharp, and people were streaming into the bright summer morning, toward the gates. But so much of ordinary conversation seemed to be about stating the obvious. How did anyone stand it?
Where are you off to?
She'd been expecting him to say home, and she had an answer for that, but he surprised her.
Hopping the train to Cambridge for the day. Sheila's already there, visiting her parents with Christopher. It's better if I don't go with them, so I'll loaf about until afternoon, and then bring them home.
Why can't you visit her parents?
Someone jostled past Harry. He moved to one side near the brick half-wall, erected to shield the hut from bomb raids.
Once her dad is 2 pints in, he'll start making digs at me, and her mum always frets about how dark Christopher turned out, and argues about me teaching him Arabic.
Harry's face was taut.
I don't see Sheila putting up with that.
She gives them hell, but Christopher cries and...
Harry broke off.
How do you know what Sheila would or wouldn't do?
We met again a few weeks back.
Beth looked down at her handbag. And talked.
About what?
Beth couldn't manage the answer.
You're off to the train station then?
Yes.
She took a breath, let the breath out.
I've never been to Cambridge.
He looked at her then, exhausted, direct.
Do you want to come?
They didn't speak on the station platform or on the train. Harry angled his big body in the crushing crowd, so Beth had a bit of space, and then stood silent, expression abstracted. Beth knew the look, having seen it in the mirror often enough. She was still fighting off the code's mesmeric hold herself, and she'd had a good shift's work, hard concentration giving way to clean, decrypted script. She hadn't spent hours banging her head against an impenetrable wall. In the cramped space between them, she raised her hand, flashed 5 fingers rapidly like a cluster of enigma traffic, and then swelled them like a whirlpool, letting her eyes cross. Harry nodded, lids lifted briefly as he grinned. As she dropped her hand back to her side, the backs of their fingers brushed together with the swaying of the train. Beth stood quietly, focusing on the haphazard touch. They got off at Cambridge, Harry taking her hand quite naturally, pulling her through the crush on the platform. He didn't drop it, and she didn't tug away. She saw spires and golden-stoned buildings, a city half-medieval and utterly untouched by bombing. She couldn't help turning her eyes everywhere, astounded.
"Cambridge is lovelier than Oxford," Harry said. "Don't let any of the Oxford blokes tell you different."
Beth didn't see how anything could be lovelier than this. They meandered, Harry pointing out his favourite spots.
"There's the Eagle, best pub in town. I used to work proofs over a pint in the evenings. The tower there marks Caius College. My cousin Maurice dared me to climb the roof at night and make the Senate House leap across the lane below. Maurice got recruited to BP too, you know. I had no idea till I saw him flashing his pass at the gate."
Cambridge wasn't as intimidating as London, but was much bigger than Bletchley. "And not a soul here knows me." All her life, Beth had lived in a glass bowl where she couldn't cross the road without meeting five people who called out her name. Harry bought a packet of ersatz meat paste sandwiches, and they ate on the grass in a loop of the river. He sat with his knees up, shoulders giving an irregular hitch now and then, and a lingering fear flashed in Beth. Breakdown. Like poor Peggy, who had returned from bed rest, pale-faced and elusive about her time away.
"You're not going crazy, Harry."
Beth said it blunt and direct.
"It feels like it."
He looked at her, speaking equally bluntly.
"What did Sheila tell you?"
Beth had hoped she could get through this without blushing, but she might as well have wished for the moon. "About someone she sees, someone you don't mind about."
"I've never met him."
Harry tossed a crust into the river.
"But I hope he's head over heels for her."
"You really don't mind?"
"She should be happy while she can."
Harry shook his head.
"She fell for a flyer. If he lives through the war, it'll be a miracle."
"So..." Beth couldn't finish the sentence or her sandwich. He looked at her straight.
"This is all I've got to offer you, the occasional afternoon, because I'm not leaving Sheila or my son. Wouldn't you rather be off with some fellow who can take you to meet his parents, give you a ring someday?"
"No." Mab seemed to love being married, and clearly Osler wanted to be, but Beth didn't feel that tug. She'd just got out of a household that felt like a prison. The thought of starting things up with a man who might trap her in another household someday made her want to scratch and howl. Beth wanted the life she already had, only...
"Why are you here?" Harry asked, low-voiced.
"Because I don't know if you're the only friend I have who does what I do and loves what I love, or if you're something more," Beth thought. "And I want to know, because you make me dizzy." She didn't know how to say that. "Why did you ask me to come along today?" she asked instead.
"Because you've got a great, big, beautiful brain all teeming with lobsters and wheels and roses," Harry said, "and I could get tangled up in it all night."
"You said it better," Beth thought dizzily. She spoke before she could stop and think, before she could find an excuse to dive back into the shadows. "Can we go somewhere?" Harry smiled. He still looked exhausted, but the smile lightened him all over, as if he were hovering over the grass and not sunk into it like a boulder. He reached out, linking his fingers through Beth's.
"Do you like music?"
The sign over the door read Scopelli's Music Shop. The premises were closed and shuttered. It was Sunday morning, Beth realized. Everyone was at church or at home. She could have been in chapel right now, ignoring her mother's reproachful stares. Instead, she was hand in hand with a married man, thinking, well, things that weren't suitable for chapel.
"I had a job here my last year at King's College."
Harry let them into the shop and began turning on lights.
"Old Mr. Scopelli let me keep a key so I can come on my afternoons off and listen to music."
Most of the shop was in shadow, but Beth saw booths with chairs and headphones. "What do you listen to?" She'd heard so little music, only what was on the radio that Mrs. Finch thought appropriate. At Aspley Guy's, they didn't have a radio at all. Harry went to the wall of records, running his fingers along the top shelf.
"Since the U-boat blackout, Bach."
"You said once it was splendidly foursquare," Beth remembered. "Patterns for days."
"Maybe that's why I've been burying myself in it, trying to find U-boat keys in the well-tempered clavier. At least it's something we haven't tried at work.
His face darkened briefly, then he gave his head a fierce shake as if to shove Hut 8 and everything about it back into the hole it came from. He pulled a record down.
There.
Nodding to the booth at the back. Beth took a seat and Harry dropped into the chair beside her, putting the record on and fiddling with various dials. He shrugged out of his jacket and pushed back his sleeves.
We'll both hear it this way, he said, picking up two pairs of headphones and slipping one over Beth's ears.
The world sealed away with a suddenness that surprised her, and she wished she had a pair of these at ISK. Then she'd really be able to focus. No distractions of Phyllida's throat clearing or Jean's slight humming. In the artificial silence, she looked at Harry, then looped her fingers around his wrist and tugged. His big hand rose to the nape of her neck, then his other hand moved to her hair, tangling slowly through it, and the silence filled up as he kissed her. Not with sound, Beth thought, gripping his loosened collar and pulling him closer. With colour. Honey yellow, sunshine yellow, flooded her to the bone in the utter stillness. He pulled back, hand still warm at the side of her throat. He looked a question at her. She smiled. He lowered his head, kissed the space between her collarbones, then drew back and pulled the record from its sleeve. Beth saw the label. Bach's Partita No. 2 in C minor. He dropped the needle, and a piano began. Patterns. Beth could hear them unspooling, golden horizontal lines, more melodies adding in, undergirding the first. Patterns mingling, left hand and right. Patterns she didn't have to solve, just admire. Harry kissed her again. Beth closed her eyes, following the left hand pattern as it surged, following the pulse in Harry's neck as it surged under her fingertips. She followed the strong lines of his throat down into his collar, listening, moving her lips to his neck. She felt him swallow, felt his hand make a fist in her hair, and it hurt wonderfully. She had never liked to be touched, but now she couldn't get close enough. Normally, Harry hunkered down in chairs as if to keep his vast size from intimidating anyone, but now she had the feeling of being pulled into the unyielding granite loom of a mountain. He could have broken her between his huge hands like a toothpick, and it didn't frighten her at all. If anything, Beth had a fierce thrum of pleasure, because he was nearly shaking with the effort to hold all that strength back. Let her be the one to move first. The world jolted as he tugged her earphones away.
Should stop, he was saying.
Why? Everything was too loud. Beth was curled in his lap, her blouse and brassiere on the floor. Harry's shirt unbuttoned. They were both breathing hard. Music came tinnily from the discarded earphones.
I'm not going to get you in trouble.
Harry went through his pockets with a muttered curse.
I didn't bring anything. Didn't think the day had anything like this in store.
Beth reached over to her handbag and showed him what she'd swiped from Giles.
I did.
Harry burst out laughing.
Don't tell me you marched into a shop and asked for...
As if anyone would sell them to me.
She felt the blush come. Nicked from Giles?
Christ, Beth.
Harry put his forehead against hers and laughed in huge, gusting waves. He sounded like he hadn't laughed in months.
Does this make me a...
Beth hesitated. I thought I should be prepared, just in case.
You're a bloody genius.
He swiped the two small packets from her hand.
Mr. Scopelli turned his back room into a bomb shelter. There's a camp cot and blankets.
Harry paused, giving her a look up and down that scoured like coal fire.
Christ, even your nipples blush.
Shut up!
Beth reached for the earphones.
I want to hear the end of the partita.
He swung her off his lap, holding her off the ground, close against him, eyes black and ravenous.
Bugger the partita.
Chapter 42. Letter from Osler to her Café de Paris Good Samaritan, posted to his London landlady. I don't know why I'm writing you. My first letter after our meeting at the Café de Paris had no reply. Are you still overseas? Are you even still alive? I hope you are. You provided comfort in one of the worst moments of my life, and somehow you've become important to me. Perhaps that's silly. I suppose I'm also writing you because I can't write my boyfriend anymore. Let's not get into why. And sometimes I need a page to scream into. This is such a bloody awful war, and I'm so tired of making everyone laugh.
Nothing missing.
Miss Senyard lowered the lid on the last box file.
Will you give it a rest now, Osler?
Osler nibbled a nail. Months and months it had taken to go through those boxes she thought might have been rifled. She told Miss Senyard she was worried about possible missing files, and the older woman had been dubious, but no one could say she wasn't careful. She and her girls, and Osler too, pitching in at least an hour after every shift, had gone through every single box and cupboard where signals, reports, and copies were stored. The stacks took up whole walls now that German naval section was consolidated.
Goddamn, a visiting American colonel had whistled last week. If this were the Pentagon, there would be rows and rows of shiny filing cabinets with nothing in them. And you do it all in goddamn shoeboxes.
Well, Osler had seen everyone checked and cross-correlated, and she was floored at all points. Nothing appeared to be missing. Maybe whoever rifled through just copied down what they wanted before scarpering, she thought. But if there was a way to check for that, she didn't know what it was.
Thanks awfully, ma'am, she told Miss Senyard. I know you're glad to call this project a dead end.
She'd made inquiries about the missing Hut 3 files too, the ones Travis wouldn't admit to, and met a wall of you didn't need to know. There was no uproar or further investigation from the mansion, and no one had been sacked from BP for carelessness. That sort of news made itself known all over the park. So perhaps the missing files had turned up without fuss. Perhaps they'd simply been mislaid. With thousands of reports flowing through BP, surely the odd stack of paper ended up in the wrong drawer from time to time.
So let it go, her common sense advised as she headed back to Aspley Guy's.
But Osler didn't entirely want to let it go. At least the mystery had kept her occupied, and there hadn't been much in the way of bright spots lately. No more Hut 4 now that they'd moved to the big, anonymous new block. Fewer jokes and more strange faces all around. No Philip to bring a jolt of sunshine into her veins. He was out at sea. No escape from tragedy when Osler translated gleeful Nazi reports in July about cracking convoy PQ-17 and sinking 24 of 30 ships. And certainly no cessation of nightmares when she closed her eyes at night. Osler wrote her Good Samaritan about that, mainly because she couldn't think who else to tell, wrapped up in his old overcoat, which still smelled like heather and smoke. Sometimes she slept in it. It smelled like a man, even if it wasn't Philip, and then she could pretend she had her head on his shoulder and wasn't just lying in the dark in her narrow bed, dying of loneliness.
Come up to the roof,
Matt proposed when she got back to Aspley Guy's. We won't get another warm day like this until spring, and you look peaky.
It's the new block.
Still the new block, even though the naval section had moved over in August.
I never thought I'd miss that creaky old hut, but these big blocks have all the boundless charm of a TB sanitarium. Conveyor belts cranking away, pneumatic tubes, park messengers whizzing in and out.
Osler shook off her blue funk, shimmied into her bathing suit, midriff bearing white, dotted with red cherries, and followed Mab up the attic stairs to the rooftop, which was flat, remote, and perfect for sunbathing. Osler laid out her towel as Mab stripped down to her unmentionables. No one was going to see them up here. The day was summer warm, more like June than October. Osler watched a hurricane drone overhead from the nearest training base and began working through a comic weather report for Bletchley Blethering's.
Warm and hazy, with a 30% chance of Messerschmitts.
Writing BB was about the only thing that gave Osler's days any fizz now.
I got your visionaire message.
Beth's voice floated behind them. Even without the dread Mrs. Finch snooping, the three of them had never dropped the habit of leaving notes for each other in code. Up on the roof, bring your bathing suit, Osler had ciphered, before dashing upstairs after Mab.
Letter came for each of you,
Beth continued, wind stirring her blonde hair as she came up onto the roof. Osler had marvelled before at the change in her quietest billet mate. Something had shifted in Beth, beyond the hair and lipstick. She hardly seemed to be present now, unless she was on her way to BP, straining like an eager greyhound to get to work. If she wasn't working, Beth didn't even seem to be there. Not in the please-don't-look-at-me way of the silent, henpecked girl Osler had first met. More in the sense that she wasn't really interested in anything that took place outside Knox's section. That, or heading to Cambridge every day off to listen to records. Something else the old Beth would never have done. So Osler supposed it was progress. Still, there was something Osler found unsettling in her billet mate's preoccupied stare lately.
For you, and you. Posted here, not through the London P.O. box.
Beth handed over the letters, sitting down on the slates and tilting her face upward.
That plane's doing another loop. A hurricane. I used to make them.
Did you? Beth asked vaguely.
Yes.
Osler heard her voice grow tart.
And you've heard that story several times. Can't you at least pretend not to utterly ignore anything that isn't in Bally code?
Beth looked puzzled. Osler sighed and tore open her letter, getting a familiar jolt of joy as she recognised Philip's writing.
Darling Oz, I haven't had a letter in ages. Did I do something to offend? Don't tell me you've met someone else, because if you have, I'll paste him.
On the heels of joy, pain, because she couldn't tell Philip why she'd stopped writing.
You might hurt for a while, Osler told Philip silently, but I'm keeping you safe.
Her commander had been clear. If she failed to keep Philip at arm's length, and there was another security breach, Osler wouldn't be the only one called to account. Philip could be too, and he had more to lose. His shining new lieutenancy, his pride in serving at sea, his acceptance from the royal family when he hardly had family of his own left. All that could go if there was talk of treason. He would never recover from a blow like that. Even a brave man like Philip had his Achilles heel.
I'm protecting yours, Osler thought, folding up the letter. Even if you never know it.
Her ears rang suddenly as Mab let out a whoop.
He's coming home! Francis is coming home!
From Inverness? Osler asked as Beth said.
From where? I thought they were going to keep him there till he sprouted heather.
Mab shuffled a ream of pages, still reading. Her husband was always writing her thick packets, and all summer long she'd been scribbling thick packets back. Osler took her involuntary tendril of envy, squashed it flat, and stamped on it repeatedly.
How long has it been now? 4 months. Ages longer than he originally thought.
Mab hugged her knees. He'll have 3 days, the 8th through the 10th of November.
How am I going to wait another month? He wants me to take the train to Coventry and bring Lucy.
A dizzy smile.
He's going to show us his house. The house we'll all live in after the war.
Osler's envy raised its head again, and she gave it another vicious stamp.
Absolutely topping. Come with me, Mab said promptly. I'll need someone to help look after Lucy, so you can boff your husband senseless each night, Beth said.
Osler and Mab turned to stare at her.
Where did you learn an expression like that, Miss Finch? Mab laughed. Clearly you've been falling into bad company. Beth, are you sloping off to meet some fellow?
Osler exclaimed in mock horror.
All these Cambridge Sundays?
She meant it as a joke, but Beth looked upward, avoiding eye contact.
That hurricane's back.
Osler's senses pricked. Maybe if Beth seemed distant lately, there was a better explanation than overwork.
Don't get in a flap. Tell me. Look, Coventry, can one of you come? Mab pleaded.
The pink in her cheeks made Osler forget about Beth. Mab was positively shining, not with the cool, hard confidence she'd radiated from the day they met, but with pure joy.
She's in love, Osler thought.
She may have married Francis for hard-headed reasons, but now she's head over heels.
Well, I'd better come along so you get your idyll, Osler said lightly.
3 days alongside a husband and wife fizzing with mutual adoration, this was going to require a lot of mental stamping. But Osler couldn't say no, not when Mab sat there visibly clutching her own happiness like it was the most fragile of vases.
If you brought Beth, she'd get the swithers, disappear down the centre of a rose for an hour, and next thing you knew, Lucy would turn up in Timbuktu.
The hurricane circled round again, even lower. Mab grinned, eyes sparkling.
Let's give him something to look at, ladies.
She stripped off her brassiere and whirled it over her head as the plane droned overhead. Osler pulled off the top of her bathing suit and did the same, laughing.
No, thank you, said Beth, keeping her blouse buttoned, but she waved.
The hurricane waggled its wings in return, and Mab blew a kiss.
Guess what, flyboy? She shouted upward. My husband's coming home!
Chapter 43 From Bletchley Blethering's, November 1942.
What on earth is the local RAF squadron to do now that it's too cold for the BP ladies of Woburn Abbey and Aspley Guys to go rooftop sunbathing in their skivvies? Go buzz the Fraulein's in Berlin, boys, and drop a few bombs while you're at it. 1 hour's break for every 8 hour shift. Sometimes Beth and Harry were too exhausted to do anything but bolt sandwiches side by side in the canteen before heading back to their respective blocks. But more often than not, they'd trade a wordless glance, make separately for the park's abandoned air raid shelter, and fall on each other. It wasn't lovemaking in there when they were inside BP's clock. It was fast, urgent relief. In Cambridge, on days off, they could stretch out on the cot in Scapelli's, talk, laugh. But coming together in the middle of a shift, they were both too far inside Enigma's pathways to pull entirely free. Beth's mind had been knotted up for weeks in the spy Enigma. By the time she fell into Harry's arms on break, all she wanted was a few minutes to stop thinking. Harry was 9 months into the U-boat traffic lockout. After 4 hours of fruitless work, he'd slam into the air raid cellar with every muscle drawn stone hard, balanced on such a knife edge of frustration and rage that all he wanted was an outlet. An urge Beth understood perfectly. They'd take a few silent minutes to claw it all out on each other's flesh, and then trade soft, wordless kisses and go back to the code. The code and Harry. Beth didn't know what she'd do without either. When we win the war, people were beginning to say with increasing optimism, because the war was starting to look winnable. American troops and supplies were coming across the Atlantic, despite the U-boat lockout. Hitler's eastern advance had bogged down in the Soviet Union's implacable ice, and something unspeakably secret was taking shape to tackle Rommel in the desert. Most people were cautiously jubilant. But when Beth heard the words, "when we win the war," she had to push down a surge of panic. Without a war, she didn't have this work. Without a war, there was no excuse to see Harry. Without a war, would she be an unemployed spinster with a dog, forced back home because she no longer had a billet and a salary? "I feel myself cracking round the edges," Harry sometimes said quietly into her hair when they were alone. But the only thing that made Beth's mind bend at the edges was the thought of losing all this. She could take the hours, she could take the secrecy, she could take the grueling pace. But she couldn't take the thought that it would all someday disappear. "Where's Jumbo?" someone called out as she let herself back into her section after shift break. They'd moved from the cottage into a gothic red brick school building adjacent to BP. Beth missed the whitewashed cottage off the stable yard, but it was too small now with so many new additions to elicit services knocks. Not just more new women, but men. "Men in my harem," Dilly sighed on one of his rare visits to the section. It didn't matter where ISK was housed or how many new people joined. The women who had broken Matapan together were still the heart of the operation. "Where's Jumbo?" Jean repeated, sounding agitated. "Here." Beth plucked a stuffed plush elephant off her seat and handed it over for a ceremonial ear rub. The elephant had come from Dilly, living in the cupboard until they were in the middle of a Jumbo rush, and the rush had been overwhelming all through October and the start of November. Scads of Abwehr traffic about something called Operation Torch, whatever that was, drawing to a head.
"I'll wager it's confirmations," Giles speculated.
He'd been moved over to ISK some weeks ago. Beth still found it strange to see him working at the desk next to hers.
"If it's really true we've got all the German double agents under our thumbs, we'll be using them to feed false information back as cover-up for Torch. No good planning a big push without misdirection. Convince the Krauts the Allied convoys are heading one way when they're headed another. All this Abwehr stuff is just checking to confirm if they're buying what we're selling."
"Maybe." Beth was rodding for the right-hand wheel position, fast and automatic.
"You aren't even the tiniest bit inquisitive."
"No."
"I can't decide if you're monumentally incurious or the purest bloody brain I've ever met."
Giles linked his hands behind his head, studying her as if she were a rare scientific specimen.
"Hitler's private telegrams or the Sunday crossword, it's all the same to you."
"I crack messages. I don't interpret them." Beth swept her hair out of her face. "It doesn't matter to me what I'm breaking. Why complicate things when there aren't hardly enough hours in the day as is?"
"Especially at my pace."
Giles made a face. He wasn't a bad cryptanalyst, but he'd got used to three-wheel work in his old hut, and wading through four-wheel stuff like Abwehr took him ages. You're getting faster, Beth said charitably.
Won't ever be up to your speed.
He said it without resentment, which Beth appreciated. Some of the Hut 6 men were disconcerted by the unconventional working methods of Dilly's team.
That's not the way this is done, one of the new mathematicians had said his first week.
And Giles had bounced a wad of paper off his forehead and said,
You crack the spy key all by yourself, Gerald, and I'll do it your way. Until then, I'm going to do it Beth's way.
Beth cracked through her whole stack of messages before looking up and stretching her neck.
What else have we got?
Giving Jumbo's ears a rub. Peggy brought fresh chicory coffee over.
Night shift's done, Beth. Go home.
This is what calms me down.
Osler and Mab were leaving this morning for Coventry. It would be dull in Aspley Guys without them, and Beth would far rather work the day shift.
Give me the Hut 6 duds if there's nothing else.
Peggy pushed a stack over.
More possible bombing sites. Giles has the list of city codes. Lodge for London, Paula for Paris.
Giles reeled them off. Beth pulled her crib sheets and rods over and began working. Not nearly so many air raids now as earlier in the war, but you never knew when a wave of German bombers would pop up like a nasty surprise out of a jack-in-the-box.
Giles, Beth called over absently some hours later, what city is Corn code for?
Corn.
He dropped his pencil, massaging his fingers.
Coventry. Don't tell me poor little Coventry is due for another raid.
Did they get hit before?
Do you live in a box? They were nearly flattened 2 years back.
Beth stared at the jumble of German words coming out of the message before her. She still didn't speak German, but they were words she saw often enough to recognize. She looked at this one and she saw corn and numbers that might be coordinates. And then her eyes caught on the raid's attack date.
8 November.
Giles,
Beth said slowly.
What day is it today?
Chapter 44. Mab was used to the sight of air raid damage, but gazing at Coventry, she realized how much London's sprawl lessened the impact of the destruction. There, if you saw a house missing, at least there were houses still standing on either side. If you saw bomb craters in a street, you saw automobiles swerving busily around them. Coventry, so much smaller and more compact, had been far more comprehensively wrecked. Mab barely counted one building in three that wasn't either reduced to rubble or sporting boarded windows. The ancient cathedral stood open to the elements, stone floor dusted with snow, medieval windows with their fire-scarred stone tracery stark against the grey sky.
Bare ruined choirs, Mab echoed.
The Mad Hatters were reading Shakespeare's sonnets this month.
The big raid was in November of 40, Francis said, also gazing at the cathedral. More than 500 killed. I wasn't in town, but I knew so many who died. There have been 2 more raids since, but nothing like that one.
He ruffled a hand through his chestnut hair.
It's all in dismal condition, but I hope you can see Coventry for what it will be again, after the war.
He said it low-voiced, so Lucy, running ahead through a puddle, wouldn't hear.
Come back, Luce,
Osler called, sauntering after in her blush-pink coat. She and Mab had said goodbye to Beth at the BP canteen this morning, then collected Lucy, who had been put on the train to Bletchley in care of the conductor, and they'd all headed for Coventry. Francis had greeted them at the station, a flat box under one arm that he hadn't yet explained. Lucy had hung back behind Mab, regarding him warily through the fringe of her bangs.
Hello, Lucy, he'd said easily. What would you say to a walk around the city?
No, Lucy said. I'd rather look at ponies than take a walk. Are there ponies?
We'll see if we can find you ponies.
Off they went, the four of them bundled in coats and scarves, and Mab was glad for Osler's easy chatter, which acted like bright paint over Francis's habitual silence and Lucy's careful glances.
Wait till we see our home to be, Mab promised her family silently.
When the three of them all lived here together, Lucy would relax and Francis would laugh more, and Coventry Cathedral would have a roof again. All it took was peacetime.
I think it's a beautiful city, Mab said as they turned away from the cathedral.
Francis gave a half smile. He was even quieter than usual, his face paler after months under Scotland's grey skies. Mab wondered what he'd been doing there. Maybe when they were married 40 years or so and none of these secrets mattered anymore, they could tell each other.
So,
Francis offered his arm.
Do you want to see the house?
It was tall, tawny-stoned, surrounded by a tangled garden dusted with snow. Mab envisioned roses, no more victory garden vegetables, because when the war was over, she would just buy cabbages at the greengrocer's. The front door creaked invitingly when he unlocked it. Mab almost tiptoed inside. A flagstone entryway, a grandfather clock ticking at the end. Lucy, instantly fascinated, tried to climb in. Mab looked into a parlour with a towering stone hearth. She could see cosy fires dancing in the evening, a dining room for Sunday lunches in a future where roasts and butter were no longer rationed. Francis began throwing blackout curtains open, and Mab saw how big the windows were, how the house would look flooded in summer sunshine.
A housekeeper comes weekly to keep things aired and dusted, he said. She's left us a cold lunch. I'll put things out. You ladies look around.
Good for sliding,
Lucy said, running her hand over the polished oak banister. Very good for sliding, Mab agreed, following her upstairs. A bedroom upstairs with an enormous four-poster, three more bedrooms. She saw Lucy hesitate in the one with a cushioned window seat.
This could be yours, Mab said, and held her breath.
Lucy frowned.
Mum wouldn't mind.
No. Mab's mother hadn't been able to hide her relief at the idea that she wouldn't have to shepherd another child all the way through to majority.
No, I don't mind if you take her on. Are you mad?
Mab had no doubt her mother loved Lucy in her brusque way, but she was past 50 and tired. She didn't really want to keep trimming bangs and scrimping for shoes.
Mum won't mind, Mab assured Lucy now. We'll go see her every week, but you'll be living here with me. Now?
After the war.
Would he live here too?
A glance through the door toward where Francis clattered in the kitchen downstairs. Yes, he would. Lucy frowned. She was wary of all strange men, and Mab wondered in a surge of bleakness if that was something she'd unconsciously passed to her daughter.
He's a very nice man, Luce. You'll like living here with us. It's not London.
In Lucy's short life, she'd been uprooted from London and sent to Sheffield, then shuttled between the two depending on the ebb and flow of German air raids. Mab could tell the idea of yet another upheaval was making her daughter balk. But Lucy kept looking at that window seat, exactly the right size for a little girl to curl up in while drawing.
Let's call this your room, Mab said, and led Lucy downstairs.
Francis and Osla had set the table in the kitchen for lunch. A pot of tea, cold sandwiches, and eggless sponge pudding with raspberry jam. Osla, bless her, was chattering pleasantries while Francis quietly poured tea. He gave Lucy a proper cup, not just nursery tea with hot water and milk. And on her chair, Mab saw the flat box he'd been carrying earlier.
That's for you, Lucy, Francis said, sipping.
Lucy pushed back the lid, looked into the nest of tissue paper, and her face flushed pink. Mab had never in her entire life seen a child look so happy.
Oh,
Lucy breathed, and lifted out a pair of tiny, glossy, knee-high riding boots.
For when you start riding lessons, Francis said.
What he must have spent in clothing coupons and favours for such a gift.
There's a riding school not far away.
Really?
Really.
Mab looked at her daughter, hugging her new boots and glowing like a small sun, as she whispered a shy, ecstatic,
thank you,
and felt her heart shatter.
I love you, she thought, looking across the table at her husband. How I love you, Francis Grey.
Chapter 45.
The air raid siren went off long after midnight. Osla jerked awake. It took her a moment to remember she was sharing one of the ground floor bedrooms of Francis's Coventry house with Lucy. They'd all played backgammon and charades, then turned on the radio and listened breathlessly to reports of joint Allied landings in North Africa. Once Lucy was drooping, and Mab and Francis on the point of going up in smoke if they didn't get some time alone, Osla suggested heading to bed. Now the air raid sirens wailed outside.
Lucy, wake up!
The little girl was still sound asleep on the other side of the bed. How many air raid sirens had a child of the East End heard by 1942? Lucy probably didn't bother waking up for anything less than 500 Junkers overhead. But Osler hadn't faced an air raid since the Café de Paris had been blown to pieces all around her. And fear rose thick and foul in her throat as she fumbled for her shoes and flung her coat over her nightdress. "Don't panic," she told herself, scooping up the sleeping Lucy and stumbling out into the pitch-dark corridor.
"Mab!"
Osler called. A bone-humming drone sounded above. Were bombers here already? Osler groped to the front door and flung it open. Outside, the darkness was thick enough to choke on, pierced by finger beams of searchlight stabbing at a roiling reddened sky. Osler saw something metallic flash through one of the searchlights. A plane. A German bomber, piloted by some fresh-faced Luftwaffe pilot, who was right now doing his best to blow Osler and Lucy and the rest of Coventry to cinders. She felt a stab of hatred so silver-bright it nearly staggered her. And then she heard footsteps down the stairs, Francis in trousers and shirt sleeves, Mab wrapped in his coat.
"There's an air raid shelter a quarter mile down the road," Francis said, sounding so blessedly calm Osler's pulse steadied. "Safer than the cellar."
And they were all piling out through the tangled garden. Francis struggled into his spare coat as Mab tried to take Lucy, but the girl clung to Osler like a limpet, still mostly asleep.
"Leave her," Osler gasped. "At least she's quiet."
Mab put her arm around Osler, squeezing in fierce, wordless love, and they joined the flood of people thronging the icy street. A child dragging a panicked dog, a woman with a kerchief over rag curls, a man with pajama bottoms stuffed into wellies. It was not really loud yet. It was all labored breaths and shuffling feet, muffled cursing and droning engines. Osler's stockingless toes scraped inside her shoes. Her arms ached, supporting Lucy's warm, solid weight. She could see flares drifting down like fireflies from the planes, lighting the ground for strikes from the air. And she thought of Philip at Cape Matapan, lighting the enemy cruisers for strikes from the sea. As near murder as anything could be in wartime. Lucy stirred muzzily, but Osler tugged the blanket back over her head.
"We're playing a game, darling. You've got to keep quiet as a mouse. That's the game."
"Almost there," Francis said as the crush grew thicker.
He had one arm around Mab, and his other hand grasped Osler's shoulder, calm and reliable. And Osler had her panic firmly gripped between her teeth. The imagined air raid shelter gleamed like a beacon, a cozy underground place where everyone would share blankets, someone would have a flask of whiskey, and maybe they'd sing "Could You Please Oblige Us with a Bren Gun" until the all clear sounded. It would be nothing like the Café de Paris. Then Francis's hand tore away from Osler's arm as a crowd of young men pushed through the throng, shoving ahead at a flat run. Jostled, Osler's foot missed the curb and slewed sideways. Pain shot clear up to her knee. She fell, managing to twist to one side so she didn't crush Lucy as the two of them hit the street with a jolt. Osler's entire body vibrated as though she'd been slammed through the windscreen of a car. Lucy yelped, fighting free of the blanket.
"Lucy!"
Mab's voice, high and panicked. Osler couldn't see her friend. The night was black and red, people streaming in all directions.
"Lucy, here!"
The world tilted and spun, but Osler levered herself up, lunging to grab hold of the little girl. Her fingers locked around that tiny wrist.
"Stay with me, sweetheart!"
A vast, percussive whomp sounded, and Osler heard the shatter of exploding windows. For an instant she saw the blue flash of the explosion that had torn the Café de Paris apart, torn her dancing partner's lungs from his chest, and she flinched, fingers springing open. In that moment, Lucy wrenched away and fled into the night. Chapter 46.
Lucy!
Mab's throat was raw with calling. She nearly fell over a chunk of masonry in the street, staggered upright, and rebounded off a woman dragging a human chain of children toward the air raid shelter. The din was deafening. Bombs fell, smoke billowed, screams rose. But Mab could hear nothing, see nothing that wasn't Lucy. How could a child surrounded by three adults disappear in an instant? Her daughter had slipped into this rushing torrent of panic and bombs and disappeared like a minnow into white water.
Lucy!
Mab.
Francis's hand like a steel band over her arm.
Get to the shelter. Let me look for her.
She didn't even answer, just tore away and shoved further up the street, panic rising red and clawing in her chest. Osler reached out with one shaking hand, the other clapped to her face, which had been scraped raw against the street.
Mab!
Blood ran through her fingers. We'll find her, I promise. We'll find her.
Why didn't you keep hold of her?
Mab snarled. She would have struck Osler if Francis hadn't seized her again.
You two look here. I'll see if she's making for the house.
Mab dimly saw the sense of that and began to fumble down her side of the street as Osler staggered across to the other side and Francis took off the way they'd come. Mab saw the flash of his hair in a jagged spear of red light, and he was gone. She flung herself against the nearest door, a house with blackout shutters blown to splinters.
Did you see a child?
No use. The din was deafening, explosions and toppling timber and the dry, growing rush of fire rising every second. Everyone was sprinting openly for the cover of a shelter or a cellar. The night choked black on terror, and Lucy was nowhere to be seen. Mab sobbed, stumbling from house to house, banging on doors, fumbling behind pots and lampposts. Anywhere a child could have curled up, small and cowering as a beetle. Dimly, she saw Osler searching across the street. A deafening crash sounded as a house collapsed, and Mab felt a sickle-sharp splinter carve a path across her hand.
Lucy!
No answer. Overhead, the roar of engines as planes throbbed through the sky. Searchlights stabbed the air, hunting them out so the anti-aircraft defences could line up a shot.
Shoot them down! Mab wanted to scream. Shoot them all down so I can find my child!
But the bombers droned on untouched, disappearing into billows of smoke. Another house collapsed, and arms locked around Mab, dragging her down.
Get down! Osler was shouting. Get down!
No!
Mab wanted to scream. But Osler half threw her to the ground in the shadow of a big brick depot, wrapping her arms around Mab's head. The explosions were all around them now, cobbles and bricks cracking and leaping like drops of fat in a hot pan. She tried to stand, and a wave of smoke forced her down again, choking. Mab didn't know where the sky was. This was her very first air raid, and the world had turned to black smoke and shrieking metal. She felt Osler trembling, taut with terror, and held on to her for dear life. As soon as the deafening wave overhead passed, Mab was back on her feet and stumbling down the street, calling her daughter's name, calling until her throat scraped.
Mab!
Osler was screaming right into her face. Mab's ears rang so badly she could barely hear.
Mab, it's stopping!
Mab swayed, gulping in a breath that tasted like ash. She looked overhead. No waves of bombers showed in silver splinters against the searchlights. There was still the hungry crackle of fire, but she thought she heard the shouts of fire wardens, the hiss of water being trained through hoses.
It's stopping,
Osler repeated. Mab had never seen her stylish, beautiful billet mate look such a wreck, curls clinging ash-matted to her neck, face darkened with smoke.
It's stopping,
Mab repeated shakily. She could feel blood trickling from her blasted ears.
Lucy will come out from where she's hiding now.
She was only hiding. It was all right. People were coming out even before the all-clear sounded, cautiously putting noses round doors, trailing up cellar steps. Mab rushed up to every face she saw.
Have you seen a little girl? 6, dark-haired.
People stopped, no longer pushing past in panic. They stopped to listen. No one had seen her.
Mab,
Osler began, voice quivering. But Mab pushed her away and lurched down the street toward Francis's house. She got lost in the dark tangle of unfamiliar streets, straightened herself out as the all-clear sounded at last. The sky had lightened to grey, Mab realized dully. How long had the attack lasted? It felt like a century. She let out a choked gasp. The house beside Francis's had been sheared nearly in half. The front facade collapsed into rubble. The inside opened to the elements. A sink hung over the garden below, sagging in midair, and the outer wall snugged up nearly to Francis's chimney was listing outward as though about to topple. But the tawny stoned house where Mab had led Lucy yesterday afternoon, where they had eaten sponge with jam, and Mab had fantasized about peacetime Christmas dinners, where Lucy had picked out her bedroom and Francis had made slow, sleepy love to Mab at midnight and their own, was untouched. And the front door was opening with an ordinary, everyday creak. Mab clung to the garden gate as Francis came out of the house and down the steps, Lucy riding comfortably in his arms. He was in his shirt sleeves, russet hair glinting in the dawn. His coat was wrapped around Lucy, who had linked an elbow around his neck. With the other arm, she hugged her new riding boots against her little chest.
She went back for her boots,
Francis called, perfectly calm, and Mab's throat closed in a half-sob, half-laugh. Lucy was giving Mab a sunny wave, as if the city had not been stirred to ash and terror all around her. Mab heard Ozla crying with relief behind her.
"It's all right, Oz," she managed to say, reaching back to give her friend's hand a squeeze. "They're all right."
Francis looked up at the house beside his with its sheared-off front face. The clawfoot bathtub had been blown from the first-floor loo and landed on his own front walk.
"Let's get out over the side fence instead, Lucy girl," he remarked with one of his rare grins, skirting the mess of ceramic shards. "Since there's a bathtub in our front yard."
Lucy was gurgling with laughter, Mab smiling as Frances swung her daughter over the side fence. And it happened. It happened so fast. Just as a relieved Mab was reaching out her arms to Lucy, the leaning outer wall of the bombed-out house toppled outward in a sudden three-story roar of bricks and beams, collapsing directly into the fenced garden. Frances had time to look up. Lucy had time for a thin, terrified wail. Then they disappeared, buried in a torrent of stone.
"I wouldn't dig if I were you, Mam."
"My daughter's in there. She can't breathe."
"Mam, your daughter is..."
"Mab, come away. Please come away.
Get off me, Oz." "Christ, look at her hands. Mam, stop tearing at those stones."
"Mab, stop. Stop, they're dead."
"Go to her, Ozla Kendall." "Don't look, Mam. You don't want to remember them like that. Will someone get the damned woman out of here, Miss Grey? I told you not to look, Mam. I told you not to look."
Someone was screaming. Someone was scraping blood and wood splinters from under her nails. Someone was wiping at a wet, grey slurry on her sleeve, stone dust and flecks of brain. Mab realized it was her.
Chapter 47. From Bletchley Blethering's, December 1942. The final couplet of Spark, sonnet from Mired, Battlefield Verses, by Francis Gray. The spark is snuffed, and then another two, too fragile fine to flame above the rue. Two sparks have gone out, and Bletchley Park mourns alongside one of its own. There were more people present at the funeral than Ozla expected. A group of Francis's colleagues from the Foreign Office, some Coventry friends, his London publisher, a handful of literary admirers. And Mab. The widowed Mrs. Grey in the front pew of the Keswick Church, red lipstick perfectly applied, black dress contrasting against a curiously frivolous straw hat with a blue ribbon.
"Why did Mab decide to bury him here?" Giles whispered when the service ended
and the mourners filed toward the graveyard.
"Because she and Francis were happy here."
Ozla hadn't wept during the service, but she nearly wept now, thinking of Mab's happy face after her Lake District weekends.
"But you'd think she'd do it in Coventry where he died," said Beth.
"Why would she ever want to go back there, for God's sake?"
Beth flushed dully over her ugly black dress.
"It's not the town's fault. They didn't know the raid was coming. Even if they had, they couldn't have evacuated in time."
Ozla choked down the urge to scream.
"You've said that about 8 times, Beth. What did it matter if the town couldn't have evacuated if they'd known? No one had known that one of the bigger raids of the year was coming to hit poor little Coventry all over again."
"Even if they'd had word, the town couldn't have emptied in time," Beth insisted, as if she had to convince someone. "It doesn't matter. Mab doesn't want to bury Francis in Coventry, and he has no family to say otherwise, so why shouldn't she please herself?"
Mab hadn't spoken to either of her billet mates since the Coventry raid. She'd gone straight to London and refused to come to the telephone when they rang. Mrs. Church had been the one to tell Ozla, hoarse-voiced, that Lucy had been buried already.
"Here, where our family could attend. Mabel's gone to Keswick now, to put her man in the ground."
The mourners clustered around the grave as the coffin was lowered in, and Ozla wished the Mad Hatters could have come. But Mab hadn't spoken to any of them either, and only Ozla, Beth and Giles were able to get last-minute leave. They watched Mab drop the first clod of earth into the grave. Her face was a pale mask, the same mask Ozla had seen when she was wrenched away from the terrible heap in the Coventry garden.
Her rending shrieks had stopped, as if a switch had been flipped.
"Oh, Mab, come back,"
Ursula pleaded silently, looking at her friend's empty face. Would Mab come back? Not just to herself, but to Buckinghamshire. What would Bletchley Park be like without Mab? Somehow the graveside service was over. The mourners broke up, shepherded by a middle-aged woman in black crepe.
"There's a bit of luncheon laid out in my parlour," she told Ursula. "Do come get a bite, dear. How did you know Mr. Grey, such a fine man?"
Ursula watched Mab walk out of the churchyard in her pale hat.
"Yes, he was."
Beth was still looking at the grave.
"Coventry couldn't have been evacuated,"
she whispered when the middle-aged woman hurried off.
"Shut up!"
Ursula exploded. Beth started as if she'd been slapped. Giles put a consoling arm around her, and Ursula looked away, strangling her black-bordered handkerchief. She knew she should apologise, but she couldn't. All she could see was her own fingers letting go of Lucy's tiny wrist, the silent, terrible heap of stones and beams, Mab on her knees in the rubble, cradling a tiny riding boot, and giving those terrible, choked screams. In the hotel parlour, Mab managed to accept a tight hug from Giles before being walled off by suits and condolences. Ursula and Beth stood with untouched plates of prune pudding, waiting for a chance to speak with her, but there wasn't one. At some point, the crowd cleared and she was simply gone.
"She went walking," the hotel landlady said, clearing plates. "Around Derwentwater, up to the lookout. A lovely view up there."
Ursula and Beth exchanged glances with Giles, and Ursula knew they were all sharing the same thought. Mab wouldn't throw herself off, would she? No, Ursula thought, not Mab. But her stomach rolled in sudden terror, and her mind flashed with a horrifically clear image of Lucy's tiny body pulled from the rubble.
"It was your fault," the thought whispered. "You let go of Lucy. And if something happens to Mab, that will be your fault too."
"Go," Giles said, moving to head off some incoming gossipers. "She needs you both right now.